This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting windroserecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of the show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Gus Castellanos, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide from the government's prying eye. Take yourself a summer holiday.
The Path to Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. Welcome to the show. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry. Episode 108 for Tuesday, February 2nd, 2021. On this day in 1882, James Joyce was born. In 1904, Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss. In 1928, Doc Watson. And in 1942, the novelist John Irving. In 1976, on this day, Americans began shelling British troops in Boston. In 1781, Maryland was the last state to ratify the Articles of Confederation. In 1918, to put an end to robberies by Barbary pirates, the U.S. declared war on Algiers. In 1836, Texas declared independence from Mexico. It was Sam Houston's 43rd birthday. In 1853, the territory of Washington was organized. In 1865, Abraham Lincoln rejected Robert E. Lee's plea for peace talks, demanding unconditional surrender. And 2 years later, in 1867, the first Reconstruction Act was passed by Congress. This is an interesting one. In 1877, 10 years later, Rutherford B. Hayes was declared president by one vote the day before the inauguration. And going a little deeper with that, that's because they made a deal. It was a controversial election and, you know, probably the closest we've ever had. And Democrats made a deal to let him be president in exchange for ending Reconstruction. So it set the stage for lots of oppression. for African Americans when, you know, Reconstruction had kind of started to heal things after slavery. Anyway, in 1889, Congress passed the Indian Appropriations Bill, proclaiming unassigned lands in the public domain. It was the first step towards what was known as the Oklahoma Land Rush. In 1901, Congress passed the Platt Amendment, limiting Cuban autonomy as a condition for withdrawal of U.S. troops. In 1917, Congress passed the Jones Act, making Puerto Rico a territory of the U.S. and making Puerto Ricans U.S. citizens. In 1923, in Italy, Mussolini admitted that women have the right to vote, but also declared that the time wasn't right for them to do so. In 1930, the novelist D.H. Lawrence died of tuberculosis in a sanitarium in France at the age of 45. In 1946, Ho Chi Minh was elected president of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. In 1956, France granted independence to Morocco. In 1965, more than 150 U.S. and South Vietnamese planes bombed two bases in North Vietnam and the first of the Rolling Thunder raids. In 1968, the Siege of Khe Sanh ended in Vietnam. The U.S. Marines stationed there were still in control of the mountaintop. In 1973, federal forces surrounded Wounded Knee, South Dakota, which was occupied by members of the American Indian Movement. In 1974, a grand jury in Washington, D.C. concluded that President Nixon was indeed involved in the Watergate cover-up. One of the things I've thought about the Trump presidency is probably there's no one out there more grateful to Donald Trump than the Nixon family. Suddenly, he looks like not that bad a president. And finally, in 1981, the United States planned to send 20 additional advisors and $25 million in military aid to El Salvador. So, lots of interesting stuff happened on February 2nd in American history. Tells you a lot about our involvement around the world. So anyway, episode 108 features a friend of mine, Gus Castellanos, who is an expert on mindfulness and talks a lot about how he became to be. It's a pretty interesting story. I think you're going to enjoy it. So here we go. Gus Castellanos. Thanks for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Great. It's great to talk to you. So it's an honor to be on your show. So thank you.
Thank you for saying that. So you and I have crossed paths over the years. There was a point a couple years ago when I was considering doing some mindfulness training, and I wanted to find somebody who in the area who I could kind of talk to and learn a little bit more about, you know, what route to take or whatnot. And that's how we met. And I heard your story, you know, you shared your story with me, and I always, I've always kind of had in the back of my mind that I wanted to have you on the podcast. So, I'm glad you're here. So tell everybody what you do and how you got there.
Oh boy. So what I do now basically is, and it's an evolving thing. So, I don't know if you heard, not to jump into it too much, but I'm now teaching a college course.
I did remember. I think I saw that. Where is that? Is it at FAU or
at Nova Southeastern? And so maybe I'll jump in and say it really quickly. Yeah, they hired me to teach a course on the psychopharmacology of illicit and licit drugs.
Okay.
And you know, with my background as a neurologist and having done, of course, my background in recovery, and I got hired by, believe it or not, the School of Criminal Justice.
Wow.
So go figure that one, you know. So that when we say, you know, what's happening, like, some of this stuff really amazes me, because with the parts of my story that, you know, ending up teaching things about drug abuse and mental health, especially the brain parts of it. Mm-hmm. Two criminal justice students, really sort of a little freaky for me, but it's pretty right on. I have a lot of life experience to share with them. So,
yeah, wow. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. But the main thing I do, of course, is teach mindfulness programs, teach them and teach mindfulness, train people in mindfulness, sometimes one-on-one, mostly in big groups. And I've done not a fair amount, but enough research on the mindfulness programs as well.
So mindfulness, assuming someone knows absolutely nothing about it, what would you tell them? How do you explain mindfulness?
Well, yeah, thanks for asking it that way, because many people will say, what's the definition of mindfulness? And mindfulness is an ancient practice, thousands of years old, and no one has one definition that everybody uses, not even the academics that have been studying it for 40, 50 years now. So we all kind of say something that's, it's something about being aware and being in the present moment and being aware of what's happening in that present moment as it's happening. And we will also add, while cultivating positive attributes, positive qualities, like being kind, friendly, and non-judgmental to whatever it is that's happening. So there's many, many different ways of wording that, but they all center around that, being in the present moment, being aware of what's happening, and keeping attitudes that are not hostile or judgmental or even just dry.
Mm-hmm. So then where does meditation factor in to mindfulness exactly? How do you explain that?
Yeah, good question, because many people come to my classes thinking that mindfulness and meditation are the same thing. And from our point of view, they're not. The word meditation for me right now is more like the word, let's say, exercise. So if someone comes to me and says, hey, I'm exercising now, I would say, well, what are you doing? What kind of exercise? Jogging, biking, weightlifting. So someone comes to me and says, I'm meditating now, I'll say, what kind of meditation? Mm-hmm. Is it transcendental meditation? Is it yoga meditation? Is it centering prayer? Or is it mindfulness meditation? Because there are specific mindfulness meditation. But mindfulness is more than the meditation practice. It's really the idea of being in the present moment throughout your entire day, as much as possible, being fully present with what's happening in this moment. So it becomes more of I don't say it's a lifestyle, but it's a way of relating to the moment-to-moment experience that you go as you go through your day.
Well, and I feel like it's particularly relevant right now in history, especially since the advent of the smartphone, because there are so many distractions that we have, and even before, I mean, we had enough. You know, telephones, just all the stimuli that exist. And, you know, I think about, sometimes I catch myself when I'm walking my dog in the morning, you know, I'm not only walking my dog, I'm walking my dog and I'm having a cup of coffee, and sometimes I'm scrolling Facebook or Instagram, and, you know, maybe sometimes I'll run into someone and having a conversation. But, you know, the practice of maybe you should just walk the dog, you know, maybe just walk the dog, or maybe just have the cup of coffee and enjoy cup of coffee, you know? And that really has been, you know, I wouldn't, call myself like, you know, I don't do a lot of mindfulness practice, but, you know, I've read some Thich Nhat Hanh, and, you know, the idea of when you wash dishes, and when you have a cup of tea, have a cup of tea. You know, I do try to do that, you know, to just do one thing and be in it, you know?
Yeah. And then of course, what I would add to all that, which is great explanation, Tom. So you also add, and then see what happens to your life when you do that, because sometimes we can get caught up in saying, yeah, you know, experience the moment as it happens. And when you're in a crummy moment, I mean, pardon my language, when this moment sucks, why would you want to be more present in that moment? And that's one of those things where where it takes the skill of a teacher or a companion on the mindfulness journey to kind of guide you through that, so you can see what happens. But getting back to your question, your point there about the social media, but also the digital devices. Looking back over time, it's sort of to me, because I got onto the exercise aerobic craze back in the 70s. It seemed to arise from the fact that we were becoming more and more sedentary. More and more desk jobs, more and more sitting. So what did we do? We responded by exercising. And then the obesity and the junk food, the diets that were coming around in the 80s, what do? We start getting into nutrition and better diets, supplements and all of that. And then when the stress started coming up, the yoga, you know, a large response was the yoga. Yeah. So the distractibility, the calling out of our attention from all of these devices and, you know, websites and all of that. That really was, to us, mindfulness being an antidote. If you correlate the so-called mainstreaming of mindfulness, when mindfulness began to get very popular about 6 or 7 years ago and made it to all the, like, Time Magazine and 60 Minutes and all of that, you could see that was the ramping up of how the iPhones got even more sophisticated, and the social media platforms are becoming more and more popular, for sure. So you're right on with that observation.
Yeah. Well, and I was talking to someone about this just yesterday, you know, I mean, the way these phones are, you know, I mean, if I'm not careful, I mean, I'll be sitting Sunday afternoon and, you know, trying to relax, maybe watching TV or doing some reading. I start playing with my phone, and the next thing you know, an hour or two has gone by, and, you know, what have I done with that time? And the answer is essentially nothing, you know, nothing of real value. And I try not to be too hard on myself about it, but also, I want to be careful about that. You know, I don't want to, that's not how I want to live my life, you know, with my head in the phone all the time, you know? And it's so, the algorithms and the way it's all designed, it's so easy to get sucked in and stay sucked in that, you know, I mean, and just now, if you think about when you're out at a restaurant, now you see a family. I mean, it's people are, you know, 3-4 different people there, all on different devices, and nobody talking to each other. It really takes something away from life experience. It does.
Yeah. And you're right about the, it gets down to core neuroscience and psychology, that they have this stuff worked out pretty well, and you're up against big algorithm. But on the flip side, let me give you some encouragement. The fact that you caught on, even if it was an hour later, That's the moment of mindfulness, that moment that just is, oh my God, it's been an hour. I've been lost in this. And you do well in not giving yourself a hard time. Credit yourself for recognizing it in an hour, because with enough awareness and practice, it'll be then 50 minutes and then right. 30 minutes. And before you know it, it's like 5 minutes into it and you're cutting it off. So good job.
Well, thank you. So now, can you talk about how you got here? How you got into all this?
Yeah, so you want the whole story, huh?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, let's hear it.
Yeah, well, there was this bang that happened 14 billion years ago, and it was a very big bang, and this happened. And yeah, sometimes it feels like it's that way. But just to be brief, so as you know, I'm Cuban born, but I got to Miami when in 1960 with the first wave of Cubans. And so I did all my schooling, including medical school in Miami. And I left in 1980 and then went around the country, did my training and settled here in Palm Beach County, where we still live in Jupiter, in the late 80s, establishing a practice of neurology and sleep medicine. And it was in the 90s when my work-related stress, which eventually led to burnout, started to really ramp up. But what I found out that back then it wasn't really well known or at least talked about, and burnout wasn't the buzzword as it is now. And physician burnout is a big thing now with the pandemic. It's really a big thing.
Yeah.
But I was going through all these things, and it was all professional. There was really nothing. Everything in my personal life was actually going well. But because I have a tendency to abuse drugs and alcohol, if that's what we say. So I started drinking at the age of 13 and smoking pot. And I partied quite a bit in the 70s and did a fair amount of cocaine over the years in the 80s while I was raising a family, you know, my young family, having the kids and starting the practice and all that. I didn't really think it was a problem, although I knew I had the tendency to abuse, if not overuse and get addicted, because when I drank or drugged, I would have a hard time stopping until it all went away. But because I wasn't doing this, even maybe it was once every few months, I didn't think it was that big a problem. But you know, between the work-related stress and that sort of ramping up a little and not having really good coping skills, I started then using the pharmaceutical samples that I would get in the office. And if you know anything about neurology and sleep medicine, and if you know anything about addiction, you would know that I got really all the goodies. Mm-hmm. So for me, it would be things like the opiates, of course, barbiturates, sleeping pills like Ambien, the benzodiazepines like Xanax, and the stimulants. Mm-hmm. And of course, I got regular prescription medicines like seizure medicines and migraine medicines. But because I got those and they were really access, it was easy just to say, oh, yeah, I deserve this Ambien tonight. And I need a real good night's sleep. Let me take two tonight.
All right.
So that went on for a number of years. And of course, I had that habit and developed a tolerance. So things were starting to ramp up and my wife was like very concerned. And I thought I was Mr. Big Shot neurologist and I know what I'm doing. I treat addicts. I know all about the pharmacology of these drugs. Don't worry. But, you know, I had a little bit of awareness that I was getting into trouble. So it happened to be, she was saying, you better go get help. And I said, no. And then my friend, a local internist here in Jupiter, calls me up and says, hey, we're bringing this new program called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction to Jupiter Medical Center. And since you're the director of the sleep center, Gus, and you're the senior neurologist with lots of pain patients, start referring patients to us, to this program. And I actually balked. Initially, I balked because I said, look, I'm a good doctor, not a woo-woo doctor. I don't do this mindfulness stuff. Hmm. And he then pointed me to the research on it, that this program comes from the University of Massachusetts School of Medicine. At that point, 98, it was around for 20 years and had some research on pain, on stress, on insomnia. So I looked at the research and then called them back up and said, okay, yes, I'll send my patients because I need help with my patients and they could use something like this. And then he told me when to send them, where they should go and all that. And then he hinted to me pretty strongly. He said, Gus, you should take this program because you're pretty messed up, you know? So he knew something was up, but he didn't know to what extent my issue was. So I decided to join the program, the first mindfulness-based stress reduction program here. As far as I know, the first one in the county, in 1998 at Jupiter Medical Center. And that was my first exposure to mindfulness. Went through the 8-week program. It was very systematic. Don't want to call it therapeutic so much, but between the group process and the meditations, I seemed to get lots of awareness. And as I started after the program practicing daily, but then I fell off the practice bandwagon. Something happened at work. It was, to me, devastating, although in reality was no big deal. And that gave me an excuse to drop the meditation practices and go back to using the pills. And the pills then, as you know, can ramp up very quickly at that point. So I ramped up into a very bad opiate habit. It still wasn't using daily, but was really starting to crave these things. And then they took away the samples. And when they took away the samples, I then, in my infinite wisdom, said, well, I'm going to have to write prescriptions for myself and do what's called drug diversion, which, of course, is illegal.
Right.
What that did was start the cycle, the spiral downward of the fear, anxiety, the craving first, then the fear, anxiety of having to go to a Walgreens and what they called before Eckerd's drug.
Right.
Back then.
Right.
And drop off the prescription, you know, wearing the hat, watching out for security cameras and picking it up and all that anxiety. And then I'd get the pills and start taking them and right away get the shame and guilt. So if the craving followed by fear, anxiety, get the pills, the shame and guilt. And
the
that
whole
cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And the best treatment for that cycle was, of course, for me, more pills.
Right.
So I really started ramping up, and there's where I became what I called, it really crossed the line into being a full-blown opiate addict. So this would be around 2000. So I'm writing these prescriptions, trying to, you know, finagle that and all that time consumption and energy that it takes to do things like that, and still managed to get through my day at work, you know, pretty well. Things at work looked on the surface, everybody, like nothing was wrong. But at home, my wife could tell, of course, because that's when I would use the pills mostly. Then I ran into a pharmacist. A new guy opened a pharmacy right next door to my office, the building right next door. And, of course, he comes over. Hey, I'm the new pharmacist. Send me patients. I need your work. You know, please, I'll do you a favor. Just send me your patients. So, of course, the next day I was over there writing prescriptions. And he filled them, and he filled them again a month later, and filled them again a couple weeks later. And then one day, after the third or fourth time, he called me back and said, hey, I need you to come back here. I've just gotten a supply. And I said, oh, my God, I'm in trouble. He's going to do something. And in a sense, I was in trouble, because when I got back there, he gives me a bottle of 300 Vicodin, those opiate pills, mm-hmm. the strong ones, and says, here, you don't have to keep coming back so often. And so he gives me this bottle of 300, and 2 weeks later, I was back for more. So that's when I really took off. And for the next 2 years, that guy became like a drug dealer to me, giving me anything I wanted whenever I wanted. So literally, I could call him up at any time, any day of the week, including the weekend, any time of day, including in the middle of the night. And he would come to the pharmacy and give me whatever, you know, no real questions asked. It's just some small talk. And I would take my pills, get out of there. And so that went on for those 2 years. And
was there money changing hands here, or were you?
Occasionally. That's a good point, because sometimes I felt he must be up to something. Why would he give them to me? So occasionally I would actually write a prescription and insist on paying for it. How crazy my mind says, let me cover my track. Let me give him some money just so he doesn't report me. But most of the time he would just give them to me. And sometimes it would be embarrassing, because I'd walk in there and all the pharmacy people are there watching me walk in, and we go in the back and he's just loud and talking and says, okay, here's your stuff, you know, and stuff like that.
Wow.
So yeah, but, I still, in my mind, thought, you know, he just wants my patience. And he was developing some compound and cream that he was making a lot of money on. So, you know, and the cream was as effective as anything else out there. So it was not a problem for me to really try it on a patient. It was the, you know, you put some cream on, you're not really harming the patient that much. And so, you know, try the cream. Doesn't work? Okay, fine. We'll try something else. So that's all I thought that was the game. But I got worse and worse. And then finally, I had to take the, you know, things were really bad at home. So I decided to take the mindfulness course again, because I really thought that would be my best way out. I wasn't ready to go to a therapist or go to treatment or anything. I was too good for that, right?
Right.
So I took the course again, and then I got some significantly more self-aware of what's happening. It was certainly within that year, the year after that, I was practicing as much as I could, even though sometimes very impaired by the pills. But sometime within that year, after taking the course again and doing some more practice, that I came to the conclusion I needed to do something. So I tried to detox myself, which I had tried before, but this time I was going to really try hard and do it. And trying to do that detox, I ended up overdosing unintentionally. Was taken to the hospital, to Jupiter Medical Center, where I was the head of the sleep center and the senior neurologist. I've been there for almost 20 years at that point, pretty well known. So when I woke up from the blackout on the following day in the intensive care unit, and I kind of looked around, I said, okay, yeah, the gig is up here. Nobody to hide from. So that was that moment of surrender, moment of truth, moment of surrender that we talk about in recovery. And they came in and they were pointing finger. They were about to say something you need to. And I go, hey, save your breath. I'll do whatever you guys want. So you got to go to treatment here. I'm going to find a place, blah, blah, blah. So I did find a place, the place that my wife had found that had actually back then a fair amount of meditation and yoga and sort of these complementary modalities out in Arizona, a place called Sierra Tucson. So I went out there and spent 30 days there and got cleaned up, and for the first time really started to appreciate the benefit, I guess, of putting out my story in front of people, feeling safe, feeling that vulnerability in front of other men. I was in the small group with the other guys, and I heard them share I remember at the very beginning, it's like, oh my God, don't say that. Somebody's going to put you in jail for talking that way, you know. But it was, you know, the right thing to do. And so that's when I started opening up. And it felt good. It felt safe. And they told me at the end of my 30 days, you know, when you get back, you got to go to get yourself plugged into one of these programs, like one of the 12-step programs, get a sponsor, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And so I took that to heart. And I jumped right into the AA program, which I found the meetings around here in the northern Palm Beach County area. Not only easy to get to because there are so many meetings, but the maturity and the recovery there was strong. And so I worked with my sponsor, which, by the way, I'm in treatment and I hear somebody, oh, you got to get a sponsor. I go, who's going to sponsor me, man? I'm a big shot neurologist. I can't go to these alcoholics. These are all some, you know, low level homeless people. They can't keep up with me. You know, that's me thinking, right?
Right.
So I find that sponsor, it took me about 2 weeks. Turns out that he's a pharmaceutical rep that used to give me some of the pills I used to use.
Oh, my gosh. So, it's funny how often that stuff happens, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's when I start, you know, getting the first was the overdose, because I had tried many times to reduce my use, to try to quit for a period of time, that kind of thing, and I couldn't do it. It never occurred to me to have an overdose and wake up at the hospital I worked at as the way to get to recovery, of course.
Right, right.
But that's what happened. And it never occurred to me that I would run into somebody who used to give me the pills to become my sponsor. But we got along well. He remained my sponsor until about a year ago when he had to move away and things like that. But I went through the steps. I did the program very strongly, and everything was going well. But about 6 months into my recovery, which to that point, you know, when I got into recovery, I heard this enough to, you know, change people, places, and things. So I really stopped going over to the pharmacy, talking to the pharmacist even, you know, just would send patients there because his pharmacy was just as useful and it was right around the corner. But I really didn't go back there. I didn't talk to him. He never called me up and said, hey, what happened to you or anything like that. We just didn't talk. But 6 months later, I got a knock on my office door, but from the FBI, telling me that they're investigating him. And so I kind of looked around. I kind of remember looking at when they say that, I'm like looking, taken aback and go, oh, no, no, I know FBI. They're investigating me. So I actually, so I asked him, what do you want to do? He says, well, we need to talk, have a meeting, blah, blah, blah. So I went to a couple of meetings and I ran this by my wife, my sponsor, people in some of the recovery meetings. And I was in a professional group for doctors in recovery, the monitoring system from the state. And everybody says, you know, you should be honest, be upfront with them. You have to kind of come clean anyway. They're going to know. So don't lie to them, but get yourself a lawyer. So I got a lawyer and sat down with the for the meeting. And I just say this because sometimes I forget about this, but I remember walking into this meeting and I'm sitting there and this is what I see. I see the prosecutor from the Department of Justice. And she says, okay, here's my assistant prosecutor. And then this is the FBI and this is the DEA guy and this is the FDA person. And this is the Postal Service person, and this is the health insurance person, health insurance fraud person. And I'm like, all this for me? Are you kidding me? I can't be that important. But sure enough, they were investigating what the guy was doing, which I didn't know until that moment what was going on. That it turns out that he was using my medical license to commit health insurance fraud to the tune of $2 million.
Wow.
So unbeknownst to me, what he would do is he would actually buy from certain people their insurance information and their names, and then he would use my name and license to order a whole bunch of drugs, thousands of dollars per drug per person. So he was becoming very, very wealthy that way. And of course, committing, according to them, it was, I think, $7 million worth of fraud, $2 million due to my name. So when I sat there for 3 hours and I did what I was told, I was really honest. I said, no, I don't know what you're talking about. All I did was write the prescription, pop the pills, did this. He gave me pills. I wrote prescriptions for myself and that kind of thing. And they sort of after 3 hours, they kind of looked around and said, you know, I think we believe you. I think you're not, you know, putting us on or anything. And then they came back a few months later and said, you know, we're going to try to be good to you, give you a slap on the wrist because your name was all over this. We have to do something, but we'll be good to you. And indeed they were, but people at a higher level told them that that had to be included. Which is another little side story, which I won't talk about at the moment, but I can if you want. But anyways, people at a higher level came back and said, no, you have to get the full felony, and you have to sign this deal, and if you don't sign the deal, we're going to do this, blah, 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 and this and that. So I talked to the lawyer. I was very disappointed and depressed and took the deal, and they still said to me, we'll go up to bat for you in front of the judge. But when I went for sentencing in front of the judge, they did come up to bat for me. In fact, the prosecutor went up to the judge and says, please don't punish this guy. He's doing his recovery program. He saved us time and money. He gave us suggestions that we didn't know about. They're very helpful. So please don't punish him because it sends a bad signal to the community if you do. And the judge turned around and said, nope, sorry. You're a doctor. You should know better. So you need to go to prison for 3 years. You need to have a medical license. You need to go to probation for 3 years. You can't get a credit card and a whole list of little probationary things. And you know, I was not really listening to what he was saying at that point when I heard, no, you need to go to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Because up until that point, we weren't expecting that. Mm-hmm. But as stunned as I was for a moment, there were 30 people in the room there with me in the courtroom that were there for supporting myself and my family. And I heard them all kind of freak out and gasp and start crying. So I kind of decided to settle myself. At that point, I had two and a half years into recovery and had been really active and, you know, the whole spiritual thing, as well as really gained my wits about me, if you will, and had been meditating almost daily through all that time. And so I knew what I had to do was just keep calm myself and try to calm people down. So doing that kind of helped me get through that. And then on top of everything, my lawyer says, hey, can you send them to a camp at least? You know, the low-level thing. And the judge says, yeah, of course, you can go to camp, but you need to surrender by next week. And the attorney goes, no. When he gets ready for the camp, that'll be in about 3 months. That's what it takes. He goes, nope, sorry. He needs to surrender. You got to go to prison starting next week. So suddenly it was like, God, I got to get my whole life is shaped up here. And so I walked into prison a week later, fairly calm. You know, not to say I was happy, but I wasn't all distressed. And then to make a long story short, the 2 years I ended up doing, I made it, I called it my razor wire retreat because I spent 4 to 6 hours a day, more or less, meditating. I did some 12-step work, some really powerful 12-step work one-on-one with people in prison. That really helped. But I also was doing the meditation work. And, you know, I would say those two things really got me through. I don't want to say I thrived through prison, but I really learned a lot about myself and, by the way, about the prison system. Some eye-opening things that you learn in there. Mm-hmm. And got through it. Did, you know, again, fairly well. When I came out, it was still a little bit weird because everything had changed so dramatically in my life. And I walk out in 2008 on top of everything with that whole economic downturn. And I didn't know what I was going to do for the rest of my life. I didn't even know what I was going to do for the following week. Mm-hmm. So at first I hooked up with a friend I met in AA and we tried to do a life coaching, spiritual coaching business using among things that things we learned. He was in AA as well. So the 12-step spiritual work and some other spiritual, metaphysical type teachers out there that he and I got into in those 4 years at that point. And so we started the coaching business online, but the probation officer thought we were scamming people. So he told me I couldn't do that. So after a few months of doing that, I had to quit that job and had to go find out something to do. And that was the month I got out of technically got out of prison. And so with a month out of prison, not knowing what I was going to do, a friend of mine from AA introduces me to a very wealthy woman who lived in Palm Beach at that time, she said to me, oh, this woman, she does something called mindfulness in prisons. And since you were just in prison, maybe you should talk to her. And I go, yeah, no. And I also do mindfulness. So I go, yeah, I want to go meet her. I guess I can go hang out with her and I have nothing else to do. And we'll just go do some charity work in prison. But when I went over to her house there, she said, no, we're not doing anything in prison. She says, what I want to do is set up a program at this Handley Center. Hmm. Do you know anything about Handley? I go, well, I knew the director back then, Barbara Krantz.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, yeah, I remember the great, great woman. And of course, I'm in recovery. And she goes, well, I want to go in there and start mindfulness. You go mindfulness. I go, yeah, that's the practice I do. And that's what I just spent 2 years doing. And she goes, great. So do you want to help out? And I go, well, I got nothing to do, you know. So it's a paid job to work in recovery, teaching mindfulness, of course. And then she says, oh, and one more thing. They just bought this thing called the SPECT scan. It's a brain scanning thing. Mm-hmm. What do you know? And I go, well, I'm a neurologist. So if you think me as an out-of-work neurologist that's in recovery that practices mindfulness now for at that point it was 10 years, you don't think that this would be like, yeah, I think this is a good fit for me. So that's how I started teaching mindfulness. And then she plugged me in. She was actually on the board from the University of Massachusetts School of Medicine, the Center for Mindfulness there. She plugged me in with her system, and I eventually got trained and certified to teach the mindfulness through that system through her generosity and stuff. So
did you work over at Handley?
Yeah, for 2 years.
Wow.
I was there for 3 times a week. So,
okay. So, yeah, I mean, I started my career there. I worked there for from 98 to 03, I guess. Quite a ways before all that, you know, it sounds like. But
yeah, I was after Hazleton and before Karen. So I was in between. Gap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I kind of got out of there before they left Hazleton. And it's doing well now. It's part of Origins, and my buddy Terry Shapiro, who's been on the podcast before, is the director now, and he's, you know, love him beyond words.
Yeah, I know Terry and John Diven well enough. John was the
the clinical director or the spiritual care director, one or the other back then.
Yeah, spiritual kind of guy there, but he was very, very good to me. You know, he came in when I was there. I would go there 3 times a week, and we talked for a while and this and that. He was good.
Yeah, a lot of good people over there. You know, and I got sober there. That's my sister got sober there a year before I did. You know, so. Lots of history over there. My heart's in that place, you know? So I didn't realize that's how that was your springboard into all this. That's really cool. So now, but you do take mindfulness into prisons too, right?
Yeah. So in 2010, a couple of things happened. First, with that very wealthy woman, we were holding every month at her Palm Beach, I'd say Palm Beach house or Palm Beach estate. Mm-hmm. She offered it to the community to have mindfulness sessions. So I also learned to sort of run these day-long retreats with her there. And many people came, but there were people from the University of Miami Medical School who came there a couple of times. And then they came to me and her and invited us to the medical school. She said, we want to talk about mindfulness. Can you come down? Now, I'm sure they had other ideas trying to get the very wealthy woman there to perhaps donate money, but I don't know that. I just know they came to us and said, hey, can you come and do some of this mindfulness here for us?
Yeah.
The Department of Public Health, which is really a good fit for mindfulness. So there's a quick side story. This was very funny because, she said, oh yeah, whatever. Wendy says, okay, come this day and come at this time. I forgot what it was, a Friday morning or something. We want you to come down here. You and to this woman and you, Gus, you and her come down here, and we'll meet and we'll talk. And so, we were going for the meeting and I said to the woman, I said, listen, I have this car it's a 1973 car. It's not going to make it. It doesn't make it to Palm Beach from Jupiter, partly. So I don't think it's going to get us down to Miami. She goes, no, we need to drive my car, the car that we have here because she's just seasonal.
Right.
Our car here needs to be driven. So you drive that car down there. We'll be fine. We'll just go down there. And so I get into the car. At that point, 2010, it's a 1994 Rolls-Royce Corniche 4 convertible. Wow. And so she asked me to drive it. And so I'm driving this car down there, sitting next to her, who's literally a billionaire. And I'm driving up to my old medical school, 30 years since I graduated, after everything I've gone through, the first time I've ever go back to my medical school.
And you're driving a Rolls-Royce.
With this woman at their request for me to come back there. And this is one of those moments of, I don't know how this happened. It certainly wasn't my idea. So, and again, the same thing with working at Hanley. So also in 2010, some of the people that came to her house worked at a local Zen group that was going to the prison. And they said, we want to bring mindfulness now. Can you help us out? And that's how we established the mindfulness program starting in 2011. And up until the pandemic, I was going out there at least twice a month.
Wow.
In South Bay. So.
So now with the pandemic, are you doing anything over Zoom? Is this something that can translate that way?
Yeah. Yeah. And it translated very great for me because for up until the pandemic, for the 10 years I've been teaching, I live in Jupiter. I had one local thing I did for veterans here in Jupiter, but most of my classes were in West Palm, Boynton, and Miami. So I was driving back and forth and, you know, driving to Miami two or three times a week back and forth. It's stressful, as you know.
Yes, yes, 95.
So when everything turned around and we had to shut down and they shut everything down, at first it was like, what are we going to do? And then started using Zoom, and now all my classes on Zoom. It translated very well. And by summertime, I was actually having more classes, partly because I had more time since I wasn't driving. And so I've done, you know, the pandemic on that level had been very good to me once I got past the first couple of months. So,
So somebody wants to dip their toe in the water with mindfulness. What do you suggest?
Yeah, I'm a believer more of getting involved with an authentic, reliable group. Yeah, and by that, I mean some that have been doing what they claim to be doing for a period of time, even though a new group may be good too. But if you're new, you want to get some stability. Sort of like going to a recovery meeting, by the way, and or a teacher. The apps are okay, but if you're going to use the apps mostly just to remind yourself or just to calm down when you need to, probably okay to just do that. But if you really want to get the most out of mindfulness, you're going to need to have some live interactions and feedback, direct feedback to you, not some general feedback. So you need to say, this is what's happening, what's going on, and here are the people that are going through that. So I'd suggest to people to sort of investigate a little bit, you know, try something out and you get a feel for it. Don't spend a whole lot of money unless it's a real legit program, and then change, or, you know, try something else. Don't give up after the first experience if it doesn't come out right.
Any reading that you suggest to people?
I get that asked a lot. I don't know of any real easy book to read. The more academic intellectual types, I can give some names. So you can get a background feel for it, but you'll never know what mindfulness is from reading books or listening to podcasts. You really have to practice it to know what it can do. And then again, the inquiry process that comes from the practice, that's why you need the feedback. That's where the real power of mindfulness is. The insight and wisdom that comes from the practice needs to be talked to with other people and that kind of thing. So
when the inquiry, what are we talking about? Like, I know about, Ramana Maharshi is big on who am I, you know, he wrote a book that essentially it's all about who am I. Is that what we're talking about? Like that kind of stuff?
That comes up, but that would, to me, would be like sort of way down the line. The simple ones are simple things like, because I hear this all the time too. I can't do meditation. I can't do your mindfulness because my mind wanders. My mind wanders, so I can't do it. I can't sit still. I'm fidgety. And we'll say, well, okay, if you're noticing that the mind's wandering, you're practicing mindfulness. Right. So if the mind's wandering and you know it, you're practicing. So we would, you know, that's the inquiry process. You fell asleep and you noticed it. You were on your digital device for an hour and suddenly you woke up to that moment. You're practicing mindfulness. You did not fail. You actually did good there. So at that level, at the beginning, your leg was cramping and you resisted and pushed and fussed with it in your head. And you noticed that. So you begin to notice what's happening moment to moment. And that kind of leads to then noticing the patterns. So every time I have this thought about such and such, I go, that is followed by this thought, which leads me down that path. And before you know it, the so-called neurologic water slides, I'm lost in rumination way down the track. So notice what's happening and noticing the patterns. And then ultimately things like, is doing that serving you?
Right.
Healthy for you or not healthy for you? And very simple clinical observation. Yeah, no, it's not helping. It's okay, well, maybe you should not do it.
Right. Well, so this is the kind of arc of your life has been really interesting, hasn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, if I wasn't in it, I wouldn't believe a lot of what I'm saying. But interesting is a good way of putting it because, you know, it hasn't been obviously without its bumps and bruises. But what I've learned is that if I keep going, it ends up okay. Now, with the caveat, of course, is that I got to take care of this moment, this day, as best I can, of course. But yeah, I never thought that going to prison would be something would be useful in one way. Even though, by the way, you know, I mean, putting this in there out there for my fellow felons, it comes with you. You know, you can't get away. And I've been turned down from many jobs, including from, I hate to say, my alma mater has turned me away. So
no, I have friends who, you know, did stupid stuff when they were really, really young, and it just kind of, it never goes away. It's always a monkey on their back, you know, getting a place to live or, you know, whatever jobs. But, all right. So,
yeah, which, real quick, but not to make a big deal about the times we're in, but since all these pardons just happened, that really burns me up when I watch some of these pardons that were given to people that were outright straight up criminal doing 10 times worse than I did, and it's like magically gone from their life. But I don't want to talk politics here either.
Yeah, well, I end up doing that quite a bit, but and you know, of course, it lots of hypocrisy going on. That's you know, as we do this, it's the evening of the inauguration day, and it's been a good day. I feel it's been a good day. You know, I feel like sigh of relief. It's been this is something I actually thought about talking to you about, because it's been a hard 4 years for me, you know, to try to, cause I care about this stuff, you know, you know, it's just felt really dark, and I've been worried that our country wouldn't survive this presidency. And I don't think it would have survived another term, but, you know, and I really kind of, struggled with, moderating intake of information and news, and have really had to be kind and patient with myself at times, because, like, especially in the last week, I've just, you know, I've been so attached to it that, and it's because I've been worried and just, anticipating this day. And I am relieved that everything went off without a hitch, and we have a new president, you know?
Yeah, so, a new president. And of course we have a new neighbor, which,
we'll see what happens. Speaking of the criminal justice system, we'll see what happens. See how long he's living in Palm Beach County, you know? But all right. So looking back at all of this, if there's a time in your life when you needed a word of advice or some support more than any other, when would that have been, and what would you go back and say to the younger Gus?
Oh, you mean if I heard it now, going back to myself? Oh boy. Well, the wording has changed a number of ways. So in the 12-step program, it's the "Thy will be done," you know, God's will thing. In the mindfulness world, which comes from the Buddhist tradition, which I'm not a Buddhist, but of course I have to know something. They say trust the Dharma. And I use the poet John O'Donohue's view is learning to live like a river carried by the surprise of its own unfolding, so that it's going to be okay. Whatever life challenges are thrown at you, just do the next right thing, take care of this present moment, this day, and just trust that things are rolling in a particular direction that is always, beneficial and positive, if you will.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to put that in a encapsulation. There wasn't one wording per se. I just, I heard it back. And then really the simple way is, hey, Gus, just get out of your own way.
Yeah.
It's happening. So.
Well, the trust thing, I mean, and ultimately what I just talked about with this, you know, the anxiety about this. That's how I got through it. These last 4 years is it's going to be okay. You know, and part of that is being a recovering guy myself and having been in some pretty dark moments and gotten out of it and, you know, even found peace and joy since then that, you know, you go through something like that, you know, how bad can it get? If you know what I mean? Like I have a trust that I wouldn't have had I not gone through something so painful, you know?
So. Yeah, absolutely. And that still allows me to have the so-called moral outrage and feel that sense of true moral injury, that something external out there, so that if I need to act, but I also know my limitations. This is why I like really appreciate going into the prison system and being supportive to those guys and anybody in recovery that calls me up. I'm there for them because I can handle that pretty well. You know, I have enough life experience to go through all that with them and not to think that I'm going to go out there and cure the world of cancer or correct the political shenanigans this way and that way. So.
Well, Gus, this has been great, man. I really appreciate you doing this. And I appreciate you being that person to me, too. You know, I reached out to you, you know, being an addiction counselor. And haven't done it for a long time. I didn't realize until somebody pointed out to me that, you know, you learn about all these kind of traditional modalities of relapse prevention. And not that there are a lot of them, but, you know, the research shows that mindfulness is what works better than anything else by far in terms of relapse prevention. And so that's what intrigued me about it and led me to you. And so I know you're doing a lot of good. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
No, thank you. This is a real pleasure and an honor, Tom. And really thank you for all you're doing here, too, spreading the word. And some of the guests you've had on there, I mean, I'd say all of them, but I haven't listened to all the program. But these are really cool people with good stories. The path to authenticity, for sure.
Yeah, thanks, Gus. All right, there you go, Gus Castellanos. If you know anything about Buddhism, you know why I chose this guest for episode 108. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please take the time to leave a review, a rating, or both at Apple Podcasts, or if you're not an Apple person, preferably Podchaser. Or wherever it is you listen, if they offer you the opportunity to rate it, review it. Not every place does. You can subscribe, like, follow, whatever they let you do at Amazon, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Listen Notes, Overcast, Pandora, Podbay, Podcast Addict, Radio Public, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube. In addition to Apple Podcasts and Podchaser. If you know someone who would enjoy a particular episode, please share it with them. Mentioned a couple books and another episode in this one, and there are links in the show notes for those. If you have questions or comments, call 561-247-4757 and leave a message on the show's voicemail. Love to hear from you. Again, that's 561-247-4757. For early access to the newest episode as well as unedited interviews unavailable to anyone else, you can support the show on Patreon right now for as little as $1 a month to gain access to supplemental content. Thank you to Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. We use their songs with permission from the band and under a Creative Commons license. Thank you to the sponsors of the show, The Manor and Windrose Recovery. Thank you to Wendy Chin at Equivox, who's been great with the website. And The Path to Authenticity is proud to support the iSpeak Media Foundation. Visit us at thepathtoauthenticity.com. You can email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. And you can listen to the Sunday playlist on Spotify. Again, link in the show notes. So, I guess the one last thing I'd like to mention is if you've been paying attention, I've done this series of blog posts for each episode where I have the guest answer 20 questions and do like a Q&A post. So I have a ton of those in the works coming out a lot, like over 20, and waiting on a number, a lot more, actually another 40, I think, past guests, waiting for them to do it. But also I created kind of a separate one, all the same questions, but this one for listeners to answer. So, you know, I've mentioned, if you've listened to this show, that, this for me, a lot of the motivation for me was to build a community. And I definitely, you know, I want to find a way to engage with you guys, especially if you're someone who's listened all the way this far into the episode. So in the show notes, you can find a link to 20 questions for listeners. And by completing it, you're implying that I have the right to post it on the website. Or I don't know yet. Maybe I'll only post it on Patreon. I haven't really decided exactly what I'm going to do with that yet. But one way or another, I'm interested in more learning more about you guys. So, again, thanks for listening. I appreciate your support. Hope you enjoyed Gus. Be back next Tuesday. Be nice.
Hey, we need a guitar player.
The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.